Rudy Giuliani ran for mayor, what he was promising New Yorkers, and particularly white New Yorkers, was order. He was saying to my white liberal mom, like, I'm your kid, I'm gonna keep them, the ones that might jack your son's hat, I'm gonna keep them where they need to be. I'm gonna restore order back to this city.
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, Sonia Harris, sitting in for John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, before Chris Hayes became an Emmy award-winning MSNBC host and best-selling author, he was a kid trying to navigate New York City in the 1990s. His experience with borders between neighborhoods and classes of people informed his worldview. Hayes's candor and tenacity could be attributed to his upbringing in the Bronx, but his passions are fueled by political reality and research. In his new book, A Colony in a Nation, he explores the dividing lines between American haves and have-nots and the systems that perpetuate inequality and injustice. Hayes sees two Americas, one a privileged nation, the other a marginalized colony within it. He challenges all of us, but white people especially, to bridge that divide. Chris Hayes spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 29th. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find the full talk and Q&A on our website at kuow.org/speakersforum. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature.
Wow. Thank you. Can you guys hear me? You can hear me. Excellent. Well, thank you for that. I was saying beforehand that I was here 5 years ago for my first book, and I had never heard of Town Hall or been to Town Hall. I live on the East Coast. I don't get to come to Seattle much, but I've been here for the first one. It was my favorite event. This is, and I'm not just doing like the politician thing. Like, I love Iowa. Is there anything better than Iowa? No, this was definitely my favorite event. And it's an amazing space, and it's an amazing institution that you guys have here. So thank you for having me here. I'm pacing because I didn't get my steps in today. And I asked them to give me a handheld microphone, so if it's not too annoying, I'm probably gonna just sort of prowl around the stage. And I'm gonna try something different. So I have a new book out. It's called A Colony in a Nation. And I'll be signing books afterwards. I urge you to pick it up, you know, move some product. You do this thing where you're on book tour. I've been on book tour for a week and a half now. And it is, to go back to the politician analogy, it is like being on the stump, right? So you kind of develop your stump speech. So I'm gonna try something completely different tonight. I'm working out entirely new material tonight. Are you guys okay with that? Okay, good. So maybe worse. Just, you know, cut a guy a break, okay? So I'm gonna do something that I haven't been doing, which I'm gonna start with the news today. Well, it's funny, you know, I've been not doing that because it's not nice to get a respite from the news. And I was in Philadelphia, and I came out and I gave them a sort of 25-minute talk about the book and the origins of the metaphor that sort of guides the conceptual architecture of the book. And at about 25 minutes, I mentioned the President of the United States. I said Donald Trump. You were like, ugh. And I was like, I made it 25 minutes. But no such luck for you tonight. So today at the White House, there was a meeting in the White House about the opioid epidemic in America. Now, there's a number of things happening with the opioid epidemic, just to set as context, that I think are important. It's hard, I mean, having written this book and having lived through the years of hysteria around crack, for instance, in the 1990s, I am accustomed to bring to bear a certain kind of skepticism when people talk about a drug as an epidemic. Often there can be a kind of panic button that gets hit, and often that panic button can lead to instituting policies that are counterproductive at best and brutally punitive at worst. All of that said, what's happening right now in this country with opioids is crazy. There are more opioid-induced deaths than gun deaths and auto fatalities. That's just unthinkable. I was recently in a place called McDowell County, West Virginia. And McDowell County, West Virginia is the southern part of that state. It's in coal country. It's a very poor place. It has the lowest life expectancy of any county in the United States. Its population, 48% of them are on Medicaid. And it has the highest rate of drug-induced deaths per 100,000 in the United States. That rate is 141 per 100,000. Now, to give you some statistical context for that rate, the highest that the homicide rate ever got in New York City in 1991, in the peak years of New York as the national murder capital, was 30 per 100,000. When I was in a high school auditorium in McDowell, and I was in a room that was smaller than this but large, and I asked people to raise their hand if they had lost a loved one to opioids, basically every hand went up. So that's the context, that's the public health crisis that's happening right now in this country. I'll give one more bit of context, which is about how this came about. It's a very complicated story. I am not an expert on it. But largely this came about through the prescription of painkillers, right? We did a story on my show before we went down to McDowell County about a drugstore in a town called Kermit. Now, Kermit is a tiny town. Kermit's got 400 people in it. And Kermit is adjacent to McDowell County. And over the course of 2 years, there's one drugstore in Kermit, town of 400 people. Over the course of 2 years, American pharmaceutical wholesalers and distributors shipped 9 million pills into a town of 400 people, into one drugstore. Now, these distributors are actually required by law to file reports when they suspect that there is illicit traffic. And one would think that, I'm not some sort of code jockey, but you could write an algorithm pretty easy to tell you something was afoot. They filed over the course of 7 years, I think, and I'm not remembering particularly, something like 2 or 3 of these forms. So they knew what they were doing. So that's the context that brings us to today. And before I even get to today, one of the most interesting parts of the campaign to me were the town halls that happened, particularly in New Hampshire, at the end of 2015, the beginning of 2016. Do you remember those? Here you have all these politicians. They've come to New Hampshire. They're inside the iconic snow-covered barns. And they're there to talk about whatever they're there to talk about, but they're doing town halls, and people are standing up and question after question after questions about opioids. And it genuinely changed the trajectory of the conversations and the policy discussion because of that. So today, the President of the United States has a meeting. And in this meeting, there are a variety of individuals. One of them is Chris Christie. I haven't even said anything yet. Now, Chris Christie was very happy to be in Washington today, and the reason he was happy to be in Washington was because a man by the name of Bill Baroni, who was his chief ally at the Port Authority, and his former deputy chief of staff were being sentenced to a combined 3.5 years to prison for their role in Bridgegate. But Chris Christie had other things to do. He was at this meeting. And Chris Christie has spoken powerfully, to his credit, about having empathy for folks who are in the grips of addiction, for treating them with compassion and treatment. And there were some other people there. There was the director of the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration. There were two people who were addicts, who were former addicts who had gotten clean. And the president starts off by talking about the drugs that are pouring over the southern border. They're pouring over the border. I talked about it on the campaign. They're just coming over. And General Kelly's doing a great job down there, but they're still pouring over. And what transpires in the meeting is darkly hilarious, because it's a variety of people who are actual experts gently trying to tell the most powerful person in the world, it's not really about the border. So gently, the drug enforcement, the DEA head is like, well, yeah, but, you know, a lot of these are prescriptions, and they've been abused and overprescribed. And in fact, we're running these days twice a year where you could bring the medicine in your medicine cabinets, i.e. not medicine that came from Mexico, and you could bring that in to our 5,000 local partners who will take that off your hands. And there are two individuals there who both got hooked on OxyContin, and they're talking about their struggles. And after this, they go around the DEA. The president, he crosses his arms like this, and he looks at the DA. He goes, but would you say it's really a problem at the border? I thought this was such an important moment, and it crystallized for me something really profound. Because I've been thinking a lot about the border in the context of the election, and if you go back, if you were watching the election as closely as I happen to, he talked about the border all the time, right? The border. And he's not the first person. There was a period of time, particularly around 2006 and 2007, I was the Washington bureau chief of The Nation magazine. And I was covering the McCain-Kennedy comprehensive immigration reform, okay? And I would talk to folks in the immigration debate who wanted to restrict immigration. They would talk about the border. The border is overrun. And you saw it again in this campaign, the border. And I would think to myself, watching this, like, he's there in Mahoning County, Ohio. And it's like, what do you care about the border? Or Erie County, Pennsylvania, or Kenosha, Wisconsin, like, what's it to you? I mean, like, what are they gonna flow across the border and then make their way to Mahoning and get a job? But the border wasn't really about the border, right? The president's focus today on the border in the context of an opioid epidemic that largely was driven by American pharmaceutical companies prescribing and distributing ungodly amounts of opioids is not about the border. And why do you go back to the border? What is that about? What is the border obsession about? The border, to me, is about order. You're in a place that is experiencing what to you, in a subjective sense, and based on the statistics that we have available, decline, a decrease in the standard of living, social unraveling, disorder. And the border, a border wall, represents the antidote, right? The antidote to disorder is order. The antidote to unruliness, to invasion, is barrier, precision, protection. And there's something about that that appeals to the deepest part of our shared socio-political and cultural DNA as a people. The first diary entry that the captain of the ship that settles Jamestown makes is, he says, first entry, as soon as we came to shore, we were set upon by the savages. The experience of the settlements were an experience of conquest. They were an experience of ethnic cleansing, but in a first-person sense, they were an experience of constant terror, right? What lay out past the clearing? What lay out in the woods? And it's the same experience of the frontier, an experience of conquest, of ethnic cleansing, but also an experience by those doing the conquering of fear. What lays out past the frontier? What lays out past the border? Will they come and take it back? The experience of the slave patriarch resting his head on his pillow in his plantation in the Low Country in South Carolina. He is in control, and yet every day he reads posts in the local paper that circulated to the slavers of slave rebellions, cautioning him not to take too light a hand, cautioning him that his only backstop if they come for him is the gun and the force of violence. Now, in all these cases, our moral object of concern isn't with the delicate sensibilities of the slaver, right? Of the settler. Our moral concern is with the people who are on the wrong side of the whip and the wrong side of the gun and the wrong side of the disease. But as a descriptive matter, it is a through line of the American project to conquer and subdue territory not your own, to bring into your sense of order a disordered land, and to be animated at every moment that it may fall back into disorder, that it may be taken back, that you've painted a target on your back, that you who have brought it to order are in the crosshairs. Lynch mobs. The expression of the ultimate in white supremacist terrorism, the tool by which Reconstruction was destroyed. Years of social progress erased for decades. The lynch mob. The lynch mob says they're scared, right? That they're enforcing the social order, that they are not lawless terrorists, but instead are enforcing the law, that they are protecting themselves. In 1968, Richard Nixon comes to stand at the podium. Wow, we got a hiss there. In 1968, Richard Nixon comes to stand at the podium in Miami Beach for the Republican National Convention to give his convention speech. And the context for that speech in 1968 is a country that is racked with disorder. There are protests, there are riots. There have been two of the most wrenching assassinations in the nation's history between MLK and RFK. Our cities are burning, he says, and tonight it is time for a frank discussion about the problem of order in this country. This speech would sort of come to be known as the law and order speech. And I'd always sort of thought about law and order as being about the law. One nation under law, equal justice under law, the law and all it represents in a liberal democracy. But in doing the research for this book, in watching that Richard Nixon speech, it becomes very clear that what he's really talking about is the order part of it. Society had grown disorderly, the social order had come unraveled, and that order had to be reasserted. In fact, if you tolerated disorder, if you tolerated chaos, you would lead to criminality. It's around this time that something remarkable happens in American history, which has never happened before or since, which is the largest uptick in crime in the nation's history, right? Now, this crime wave is very real. It's not some social construction. It's not the paranoid, feverish imagination of people who are the shared inheritors of our cultural heritage, who are maybe disposed to be fearful. Homicides, general violent crimes go up about 400% between 1966 and 1979. By 1991, there are 2,300 homicides in the city of New York. Last year, there were about 350. It is at this time that a new kind of politics develops that draws on old kind of politics. It's at this time that law and order politics make themselves felt from every race from dog catcher up to president of the United States. And that fear, that white fear, one of the most powerful forces in politics, a force that if you cultivate, you are enriching political uranium for a nuclear weapon. It is brought to bear. And the arguments are so seductive. This lawlessness, this crime you fear in a city that after the civil rights movement is starting to integrate rapidly, we can protect you from it. We could punish the evildoers and the thugs and the criminals who threaten to overrun. It's at this same moment that much of the civil rights struggle for desegregation particularly comes to northern cities where often they are beaten back, the infamous Boston busing riots, for instance. Fights over affordable housing. And at every thrust and parry of every municipal dispute between a homeowners association or a school district or a city council district about where this housing is going to be placed and who's going to be in this school district, borders are being drawn. Now, this fear that this produces is not to me some sort of alien thing, because I felt it myself. I was 12 years old in 1991. And I lived in the Bronx, and I just started going down to Manhattan every day to go to a public magnet school that took kids from all five boroughs. And this school was on one of these borders, right? On one side, in the neighborhood that I went to school on 94th Street in Madison, was the Upper East Side, which is affluent and white. On the other side of the border was East Harlem, which is poor and black and brown. And at this time, which was New York City in the crack years and at its peak violence, we got jacked all the time. It was just a sort of routine. I remember going to a dance one night. I was walking with these girls who I was trying to impress. And this kid came up and he's like, "Run your bus pass." And I was like, "What?" He's like, "I said, give me your fucking wallet." And I wanted to be like, "Actually, that's not what you said." He said, "Run your bus pass." But I reached into my wallet and he knocked it down on the ground. And I was maybe going to try to take it back. And he whistled and this group of kids came up and they looked at me and I just gave them my bus pass and they went off. And I felt angry and I felt humiliated and I felt emasculated. And that was just one time. Now, nothing ever bad happened to me. I didn't really get roughed up in any way. I never faced any lethal threats or anything. But it was a condition of walking through the city to have that in the back of your head. I was talking to some friends when I was going through final drafts of this book, and I was rereading the portions of the book that were about this time in my life and thinking I was being a little overly dramatic. And I was in a park with these friends of mine who I'm still friends with today who also went to that school. And there's actually someone in this audience who was there with me. Not there, but at the school. And I was like, am I imagining that? And they're like, "No, dude." Like, we would have, when we were 12, like the cool thing at the time, and this will hit like a certain age group exactly right. Only 90s kids will understand. We all had JanSports were the cool backpack, right? Yes, nice, yeah. Y'all remember that? Yeah, and did you guys do the thing here on the West Coast where you like collected the little strings? That's like the one dude that went to high school with me is clapping. Everyone's like, "I don't know what you're talking about." But not only did you wear a JanSport, like you wore a JanSport low on your back. Like, but super low so it wasn't comfortable. Because that was cool. And so when you walked, it just like hit your butt like this. But the thing about wearing your JanSport that low is that you couldn't really run with it. So what would happen is like you'd be walking around and you kind of like looking around, gauging what's going on in the city and like who's over there and who's over there and who's over there. And maybe like out of the corner of your eye, you would sense some threat. And then you'd like grab the straps and go, just get that backpack right riding up here so you could book. You know, that fear was there the whole time. And it wasn't just me, obviously. The city felt it. And when Rudy Giuliani ran for mayor in this context, what he was promising New Yorkers, and particularly white New Yorkers, was order. He was saying to my white liberal mom, like, I'm your kid, I'm gonna keep them, the ones that might jack your son's hat, I'm gonna keep them where they need to be. I'm gonna restore order back to this city. It was the same argument that Richard Nixon had made in 1968. It's the same argument the president has made about the border, right? And it was an argument that drew on this article in 1982 by these two individuals, Kelling and Wilson, called Broken Windows. And what Broken Windows is about the ways that disorder lead to crime. The theory of broken windows is that if you're in a neighborhood that has broken windows, one broken window or two broken windows, soon you'll have three broken windows and four broken windows, and before you know it, chaos will ensue. And that approach to policing was adopted by William Bratton, who at the time was the head of the police department for the New York City subway system, which was kind of famously, in a sense, a site of disorder and disrepair. Like, do people remember the images of the New York City subway system from that time? The city was an icon of disorder, particularly in my youth. Like in the Bronx. There were all these abandoned buildings in the Bronx. And at some point, Mayor Koch decided like the way they were gonna deal with that was gonna put like window decals in the windows that had like a flower box and like Venetian blinds. But they didn't like vary up the decals enough. So it looked like this like completely Soviet project where every single window had the same colorful image of Potemkin happiness. So Nixon in that speech, he has a line in the speech where he's sort of trying for some kind of faux equanimity. And he says at some point, you know, black citizens want the same as white citizens. You know, they don't want to be just the subjects of state aid. They don't want to be a colony in a nation. And that term really just stuck with me, that phrase, a colony in a nation. Because when I was reporting in Ferguson and when I was reporting the west side of Baltimore and when I reported in New York and in Chicago, there were so many people that I talked to who were experiencing the police as an occupying force. There were people who were experiencing the police, a form of humiliation in the face of the police that is a form of humiliation that does a crucial and fundamental violence to our shared democratic principles. There was a kid in a parking lot in Ferguson who showed me a video. And it was a video of folks in Ferguson who were in the front yard of their own house, drinking red Solo cups. You guys know what those are, right? Yeah. Okay, good. You'd be super out of touch if you didn't. And they're drinking from red Solo cups, and in the background, you can see the blurry lights of a police cruiser. And behind that police cruiser, it's at night, or in front of the police cruiser, you can see a phalanx of cops in a V formation. And they're hard to make out, but the folks who are in the smartphone sort of shaky frame start to get agitated, and someone starts narrating into the phone. They're coming toward us, they're marching, and they're coming towards us. And as he holds out the phone, you can see that there's this wedge formation of cops. And they're wearing the riot gear that looks like it was designed by like a Marvel comic book artist. You know that riot gear? Bulges here and bulges there. And and they have their batons, and they're sort of walking laconically, very slowly down the street. And the police bullhorn is telling these people who are in the front yard to get off the front yard and go in the house. And folks in this front yard start getting agitated, and the person who owns the house is like, this is our yard, this is my house, this is my property. And a bunch of people start saying, hands up, don't shoot, which was the rallying cry in the wake of Mike Brown's death in Ferguson. This is two nights after Michael Brown was shot and killed. Police keep coming. Bullhorn tells him to go back in the house. Crowd gets a little more agitated, and then, boom, tear gas canister. Fired into the yard. The camera frame goes shaky as the person holding it hits the ground. Bedlam ensues. People are screaming. The person whose yard it is furious. His friends have to restrain him as he's yelling, this is my house. This is our property. They finally calm him down, and the person who had been narrating looks in the phone and says, why do you think we say fuck the police? This shit. The politics of order have brought us a nation that is divided into two regimes of criminal justice. Those regimes interlock like a latticework in inner city neighborhoods and in long stretches through counties. Those two regimes represent different spheres of citizenship. In the nation, the police sort of function like your laptop's operating system. It's working in the background. You do what you do. The ideal amount of interactions you want to have with the police is zero, right? We agree on that, right? I mean, you don't want to be the victim of crime. You don't want anyone you love or know to be a victim of crime. You don't want to be suspected of a crime. You don't want anyone you love or know to be suspected of a crime. You want to have basically nothing to do with the police ever. In the colony, law enforcement functions like a computer virus. It disrupts. It intrudes constantly. The disruption itself is normal. The disruption itself has to be planned about. And in the colony, the experience of citizenship is an experience of humiliation that we would associate with an unfree nation. The point of this book is for us collectively, and when I say us, I'm going to be specific here, white people. Okay, white people? This political system was not built by some special interest, and it was not negotiated in a backroom deal. It's not like the bankruptcy bill or small bits of deregulation the coal industry is able to convince the president to sign. This was a democratic project. It was a democratic project that was formed through the call and response of white fear over a period of 20 to 30 years that has produced a nation in which one out of every four prisoners in the world is an American. Think about that. I mean, you can go right now to an arraignment court in this city or any city in America, and you can just watch the conveyor belt roll through. It's like Lucy with the chocolates. And that system lies in fundamental conflict with the things that we say we believe as a democratic people. And so the project of this book, I'm going to take questions in just a second. You guys with me still? Okay, good. The project of this book is, if we made this democratically, we can unmake it democratically. Right? And the project of this book is to tell all of you that are sitting here tonight, and everyone that's read the book, that we own it as citizens. What's so seductive about the idea that powers it all is that we can build some wall and be okay where we are. I mean, I'm seduced by it. I live in New York City now. Crime is down. I own a home. I got two kids. I don't want to be bothered. I don't want disorder. I don't want graffiti back on the subway. Right? There's some part of us, there's some part of me that thinks if real equality were to come, I'd have to pay some price. That it is zero sum. That if we did let the disorder creep back in, then I'd be paying that mental tax I used to pay when I was 12 years old walking around my JanSport. I don't want to pay that. But there's another part of me. It's a part of me that I cling to, particularly in these times, that thinks that a world and a nation in which we flourish together is possible. That the system we've created offers us the promise of safety and security, but it brings us repression. And it hurts us as a people, as a collective entity. It lights on an unbelievably massive bonfire the talents and dreams of aspirations of millions of our fellow citizens every goddamn day. And the country we would be if we tore down those walls, if we relinquished that call for order, if we focused instead on things like safety, right? A different thing. Safety, treatment, trauma, care, empathy, education. We would all be better off. So I'm going to leave you with this and then I'll take questions. You look like the kind of audience that will get this reference, so I'll go ahead with it. You guys know cognitive behavioral therapy? Okay, I thought so. In cognitive behavioral therapy, the idea is that you have these sort of subconscious mental routines and habits, these kind of neural circuitry that gets fired and you don't realize it as a distinct and present entity. It just sort of runs there in the background and it can be bringing you all kinds of distress, anxiety, depression, and the idea is that, not that I've ever been through this, the idea is, I've heard, read in books, the idea is that you recognize those routines for what they are and you sort of yoink them out and you examine them here, right? I think we need to do that with the way we think about order and punishment. That's the point of this book. It's to get you to take those parts of the brainstem that start getting fired, the deepest parts where the cheeks get flush, and to pull that out and examine it and think for yourself, what are my commitments? What do we really want? And what kind of country do we want to be? Thank you.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum, featuring journalist and author Chris Hayes. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on March 29th. Tune in again soon.